Hello, I'm Alberto Salvato. Welcome to Crime Time, a Virginia criminal law podcast. I'm here with Anna Dvorak, Anthony Norse, and Ann Thayer. Enjoy the show.
So here it is, legal disclaimer, because we are lawyers and we've got to write one. So if you are listening to this podcast, thank you. We sincerely hope you are listening to this podcast for its entertainment value and not with the intention of acquiring legal advice for any individual case or situation. I mean, come on, you wouldn't take advice from someone you have never met or spoken to directly, right? If you were bleeding profusely, you wouldn't listen to a podcast in hopes of a bandage somehow materializing over the internet and onto your 3D printer. Seeking actual legal advice can be just as important as a tourniquet. The hosts of this podcast are in no way intending to create an attorney-client relationship with any listener. Sorry, we are sure you all are great people, but we cannot stress enough how little we know of you and your case. And rather than risk an awkward moment, let us just remember we have never met. Nothing on this platform should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation. We are just a group of friends with differing opinions and viewpoints, which we will try to explore through discussions of current events, law changes, and whatever else floats our fancy.
Welcome back to our podcast. We are going to talk today about protective orders, and our episode is called Nothing Says It's Over Like a Protective Order. We are very lucky today to have a special guest. You may remember him from an earlier episode. He's our dear friend, Chris Holly, who he's a huge Penguins fan. And we are welcoming him back. He's very experienced in the areas of domestic violence and civil cases and criminal cases. And we're going to pick his brain over protective orders and how they can impact you. Chris, you want to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you for having me back, Miss Thayer. As you said, my name is Chris Holly, and I'm an attorney in Fairfax, Virginia. I've been practicing law for over 25 years, mostly with the folks that I'm seeing on my screen.
And I just want to point out that he's wearing a Crosby sweater right now. But anyhow, thank you for coming around, Chris. Many of us have had lots of experience with protective orders, but I will tell you that the queen of protective orders,
favorite.
I cannot stand protective orders. Not that I don't like doing the trials. It's just I tend to stay away from the drama. Save the drama for your mama. But Anne is the queen of protective orders, and she is fantastic at them. And Anna does a fantastic job as well, and so does Anthony. Chris Holly, of course, is always great at whatever he does. So,
well, now that we're done with Alberto's babbling, we're going to get into some protective orders. And one of the main reasons we have Chris on today, Chris Holly and Anne are amazing at protective orders. And Chris Holly does a lot of divorce work, and so he sees how they're used in divorce. So let's just start out with understanding what are the different ways in Virginia you can get a protective order. There's through the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, you can get a protective order against your spouse, your live-in boyfriend, the father of your child. You can get a protective order against another family member, depending if they live with you. But as long as they're in the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, there has to be some sort of familial connection. Or if there is a protective order that someone's getting for a child against another person, then that would be in the juvenile court as well. And then, of course, we have in the General District Court, we have protective orders there as well. That's where we usually see neighbors versus neighbors, protective orders between friends, former roommates, people who don't have a familial connection but have another relationship with people that have gone bad. And so that's just the quick rundown of where you can get protective orders, and take it away.
So there's a couple ways you can first obtain your protective order. If there's a criminal charge issued, like a domestic assault or an assault and battery, the statute requires the magistrate to issue a protective order with that charge. And so an emergency protective order can be issued for up to 72 hours, prohibiting contact, or sometimes they allow contact, but it has to be peaceable, which means you have to keep the peace. No, don't destroy any property, no assaultive conduct. So you can get it that way. You can also go to the magistrate to get an emergency protective order. Sometimes they'll issue it overnight for like 24 hours to give you time to be able to get to the court and file your petition. And then the main way people will go to get protective orders is to go to like Anna said, the General District Court or the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court. And you usually fill out a petition and an affidavit. You swear under oath to whatever the reasons are that you're requesting the protective order. A judge will approve it, and you'll get your protective order issued that same day. If they deny the protective order, they still get set for a hearing, but you won't have a protective order in place pending that hearing usually. When you go to file your protective order, there used to be that you could either do it orally, where you're going in front of the judge and just verbally telling the judge like why you need it. And then especially over the pandemic timeframe, they were doing everything on petitions, a lot of times over Zoom or just over sending emails and things with your documents because you couldn't come in to get it. So a lot of things have been in writing and we've been able to get those affidavits and the petitions if you're on the defending side. Or as a respondent, you're able to fill it out and have it with you. So it's important when you're filling those out that you tell as many details as you can or not, depending on what your strategy is, I guess. But just know whatever you put in there, the other side is going to take advantage of. And so I know some people prefer the verbal hearings because then there's not a record of it. You can get your protective order and nobody really has an idea of why you even wanted it. And then you can file for a bill of particulars to try to find out if you're on the defense side and you don't know what's going on and they did it verbally, you could ask the judge, say, hey, I need to know a little bit more about what this is so we know how to defend it.
In my experience, it has been mostly on the defense side. And I know, you know, a lot of my clients, they get served with this piece of paper and it can mean a lot, especially coming out of the juvenile and domestic relations court. You can get actually kicked out of your house. You can lose some custodial rights to your children during the pendency of this. And your pet. That's right. And you may be forced to pay even utility bills. And I'm sure, Chris, you've seen plenty of that in your practice as far as the ramifications of a domestic or juvenile and domestic relations protective order?
Well, by and large, most of the protective order cases that I get come from the criminal arena, hand in hand with an assault and battery on a family member or some other act of violence in a family member case. But yes, yeah, some people do use them in connection with divorce cases in order to try to get two bites at the apple for some kind of pendente lite support or temporary support, or to put the other person in an unfavorable position outside of the house so that you can exclude them from the house. So there's all kinds of things that protective orders are good for, but there's a lot of things that they're abused for. I guess one of the things we should probably answer, and probably Ann or Tony can answer this, I don't think anybody's really explained what a protective order is.
Right. And we were going to get to the fact that, you know, to get a protective order is an order of the court, and the court has to find that certain statutory elements are there for in order to have a protective order. You can't just go to a court and say, I want a protective order. You don't like this person. You have to explain that you're in danger of, you've either been a victim of bodily harm, you're in danger of the bodily harm. There's a bunch of, you know, stalking, different things like that are bases for getting a protective order, but you can't just get it. And in a protective order, once you have those bases, is supposed to either protect you, as Ann said, from somebody having assaultive contact with you to all the way up to having zero contact with you. And in fact, having to stay up to 500 feet away from you. And it can be issued for up to 2 years.
The thing is, it's not just about an act of, so it has to be an act of violence, force, or threat. And the code defines those things. And stalking, for example, can count as an act of violence, force, or threat. But you can't just say, oh, this person hit me, I need a protective order now. You still have to prove a couple other things. One is that you either have bodily injury or that you have a reasonable apprehension of death, sexual assault, or bodily injury. It's a very specific harm. I get people that say, well, I'm afraid they're going to tell my boss and I'll lose my job. Or I was having an affair and now he's going to tell my husband and I'm afraid of what's going to happen. Those are not the kind of fear that the court is looking for with the protective order. And then once you have those two things, the act of violence, force, or threat, and then either the bodily injury or that reasonable apprehension of fear, the judge still has to find that it's necessary to protect the life and safety. So sometimes things happen and a judge will say, I think something happens here. Maybe you're afraid, maybe you're not, but I don't know that it really rises to the level that I need to step in and issue this protective order.
And it's a very serious consequence to have a protective order issued against you. If you're a police officer, you can't work basically because you can't even possess a gun. So a lot of people are put on administrative leave or maybe even lose their jobs. So it's something very serious. And
well, it's also true for people that are in the military.
Yes.
Because they're not allowed to possess their weapons. I guess what I was really asking is, what is a protective order? Not how do you get one, but exactly what is it, so that people who are listening can understand what a protective order or what a restraining order is?
So it's an order that the court puts in place that give set parameters on what a person needs to do so that you can feel safe without that person coming either to your home, to your work, coming within a certain distance of you. Judges say all the time, this is a piece of paper. It's not necessarily going to protect you. Like if the person wants to violate that, there's no controlling that, right? But it gives people a peace of mind because if somebody violates those conditions that are in that order, it gives the court more of a hold over the person where criminal charges are going to be issued. And then you're looking at mandatory jail time mm-hmm. if you're convicted, because the judge cannot suspend all the jail time, even if they want to.
And if it's a second arrest of a violation, I believe there's a presumption against bond if you have a prior.
Yes, there's been a presumption against bond. And there's also more mandatory time right. with the second if you're convicted of a second.
The first has, you cannot have all suspended jail time in a violation of a protective order. You have to have at least a day, if I'm not mistaken.
It just says some jail time. Like a couple hours. Like right. It really is.
I have never seen a judge sentence somebody to a couple hours. So generally speaking, they're probably going to say, I sentence you to, you know, say 99 days or 90 days with 89 days suspended. But either way, you definitely will see the inside of a jail, even if it's just to be processed. So it's very serious to hire an attorney and talk to somebody if you're defending against one. But if you're petitioning the court, you should find one who can represent your needs there as well. And there's different conditions that you can seek, whether or not you're in the juvenile court or the general justice court. And there's more protections, I think, for the juvenile court order.
Now, Alberto, with the presumption against bond, we know there's been some changes in the law about presumptions, and now there's a presumption for release. Is the presumption against bond, is that going to stay for those types of second and subsequent offenses? Do you know, or is that something that...
That's something I'm going to have to look up, and a lot of changes are coming. So I need to look that up. I haven't had that case yet.
So my understanding is on July 1st, the presumption against bond ends altogether.
So the answer to that, Anna, is there will be no presumption against bond.
Well, I figured I would throw it
very
out
very good,
there.
Alberta.
Yeah, some say I'm a master of the law.
Yeah. Some people would say you're some sort of savant, but I won't describe which kind.
Oh, that's what Tony even is. Tony is the genius of the bunch here.
Yes, that's why we never hear from him. He's just embarrassed to be around us.
He's like, I can't believe I got roped into this. Yeah, I just gotta go back into MI6 or whatever that is.
Well, but the presumptions of bond also, even until July 1st anyway, apply in the criminal cases. What's important to remember about a protective order is this is a civil process. So it's actually a civil petition that you're filing, asking the court to give you some protection. And then the court looks over what you're asking for. And sometimes they award you everything and sometimes they don't. One of the things that's different is, for instance, in the juvenile and domestic relations court, your pet can be assigned over to you. They can order mental health and substance abuse treatment, but you're not on criminal probation like you would be if you were convicted. It's a contempt charge, basically, if you don't comply with it. They used to have a monitoring process here in Fairfax. I think I don't think they have the staff to support it, from my understanding. But there's different ways the court will monitor things to try to get you the help and services that you're seeking, or that the complaining witness or petitioner is seeking. And so if you're somebody that is in need of protection and you don't want to call the police or you don't want criminal charges, it's important for people to know that the civil process is a way to go. Some people just want protection. They're scared and they don't want to go to court. So the civil process to them is a little bit less scary than having to call police in a criminal case. What do you guys think about that?
I think it's important to remember that what we were saying before is that the protective order itself is just that. It's an order of the court telling somebody to refrain from doing stuff or do some other stuff, but it can only be enforced if you want to make sure it's enforced. You eventually will have to call the police if somebody is violating that protective order.
I find it to be a particularly effective tool that you can use that is short of criminal sanctions, because in my experience, most people will follow the protective orders. Of course, there are other people that don't follow the protective orders. I just finished a case where a young man got three of them right in a row upon the initial arrest for the assault, violated the EPO, thought that the 72 hours had expired at noon instead of midnight, violated it again. And then the third time he used a third person to contact the person in violation of the protective order, saying, I didn't contact them. So you have to strictly comply with the terms. But I think that they can be a very useful tool in getting your message across that, hey, I don't want to be contacted anymore, and I don't want you to be around me.
And it's also one of the quickest ways to get before the court. These protective orders take priority on the court's docket. And so instead of waiting for the criminal process, instead of waiting for a divorce or custody, people often use these things to get into court quickly because they have to be set within 15 days. So that's a very quick process. And so when you're looking at all your options for what you want to file, this is something that people use a lot because they can get into court and be heard by a judge that much quicker.
And Chris, have you seen situations where people will start with the protective order just to get a head start on a divorce or to get the custody locked down pretty quick?
All the time. And it's very unfortunate to see people use them in connection with divorce cases unless there is real danger to the person. The protective order is an extreme remedy that's supposed to be used when you're seriously fearing for your life based upon the actions of the other person, not because you have this unreasonable belief that they're crazy or that they could hurt you. It's where you can demonstrate that by this person's behavior, actions, or conduct, that they've engaged in such outrageous conduct that you're afraid for your life. So, but you see it all the time in these divorce cases. I had one in Prince William County that we had a whole hearing. The judge denied it, and then the petitioning spouse appealed. In fact, today they sent me an order withdrawing the appeal when they realized that they weren't getting anywhere with it. They didn't get anywhere in the juvenile court. They didn't get anywhere with their pendente lite relief in the domestic side and the circuit court. And they realized that on appeal, they weren't going to get anywhere there. It's only supposed to be if you are truly in danger and there's a threat to your life or your safety.
But the go ahead, Dan.
I think they're used a lot too in custody cases. Yes. I just had one where the dad filed it on behalf of the daughter for next friend. And it was very clear. He even wrote on the front of the affidavit, custody and protective order. And it was very clear that the facts were solely focused on parenting issues and things like that. And it was denied. And, you know, the judge kind of gave them both a talking to and said, you know, we got to make this about the kid. But parents use these a lot, I think, and they try to coach the kids. There's a lot of videotaping of kids that are going on. I can't tell you how many cases I have now where people are like, oh, I'm taping the kid because he tapes the kid and here's what's going on. And, you know, they're all trying to get the kid to say what they want them to say. And I think we all can tell you no judge wants to see that. If you're manipulating your children, you're not winning any kind of custody. And I know you've had some of those, Chris.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times people misunderstand the basis for getting a protective order or a restraining order. They may talk to their friends and the friend's like, this guy's crazy. You need to go get a restraining order. You don't just go and ask for it and the judge gives it to you. Like we were describing before, there's a very set standard and things you have to be able to prove or demonstrate before you're entitled to one. And it's not just because you think the other person's, you know, making bad choices by letting the child stay up until 11:30 at night eating cereal. It really is for violent actions and behaviors and stalking behaviors.
Unfortunately, a lot of people have the incentive or think there's an incentive to go for the protective order route because seeking a custody hearing on a custody case takes so long. And, you know, you may file for a petition for custody in August and you may not be heard until December, January. So a lot of people will tell them, look, well, you know, if you come up with this on a protective order or try to seek it this way, the protective order does give the power to the judge to at least structure some sort of visitation for a child or to grant custody to one party or to the seeking party. So it's the incentive is there. And I'll say as a defense attorney and one that defends against protective orders, I always have a suspicion that these are being sought for other reasons, even immigration reasons, even for, you know,
revenge
or just, right. You know, it's amazing what things come out there.
The other thing if the judge awards a permanent protective order, it can stay in place for up to 2 years.
Yeah.
So that's
and it has consequences. It gets entered into the Virginia and national criminal databases. So if you're moving within Virginia, or if you're moving to another state, they can be registered in those places so that you can still have protection. One of the last thing a judge or people usually tell someone that gets a protective order is put copies of it everywhere. So if someone violates, you can go and have it served. And so these have implications for people when background checks are being run, the firearm rates, you know, jobs. You can have, I've had people have issues with their apartment complexes that they weren't able to stay once they had these. Like, these have legitimate issues that people have to address. And sometimes the behavior is not right, or not sometimes, I'd say a lot of times it doesn't even rise to what the protective orders were designed for.
Right. And then we also,
well, we've all had those. Yeah.
Well, we, and we also, the other thing that, you know, that happens too, is that it's very, it seems to be relatively easy to get preliminary protective orders, even if the permanent protective order is not issued. The sworn-in affidavit, especially in cases where it's not a next friend with a child, but it's a woman versus a man or vice versa, like, they get up there and say, this person assaulted me, I'm afraid he's going to do it again. And before, you know, the pandemic, they didn't, there was a policy to allow people to verbally give their testimony. Well, when they do that, they don't have to put it on writing. You know, we were getting issued a lot of preliminary protective orders that once you got to court, that's not how the thing worked out at the permanent protective order hearing. But it also caused a lot of other costs, because as Anne said, without getting a written petition, then you, if you didn't feel comfortable going forward in the 2 weeks, then you would ask for a continuance as a respondent's counsel to get discovery so you could actually adequately defend the protective order. But it's really easy to get that preliminary one. And that's actually the one, more even so than the emergency protective order, that people trip up on. They send that email. They send an email to somebody, they do something that just violates it. Or my favorite is when the person who gets the protective order allows the person to come back in their house and says, invites them over, says, I need you to watch the kid. And then they do something they don't like and then call the police on them and get the protective order enforced, even though, you know, you knew you weren't supposed to go there, but that person contacted you to come in.
The other one is when that person who has a protective order keeps calling and texting and
you know, I've won some of contact, those are great.
Trying to contact a person who's not supposed to, and finally this person like will call back or respond back, and he's in trouble for violating a protective order. So and look, that's the only person that is restricted with an order is the respondent. It's not the petitioner. So
I had, be careful. Years ago, I had a case where I was waiting for the case to be tried in juvenile court in Fairfax. And I look over and there's my client running across the juvenile court, and the petitioner is running after him saying, just shake my hand. And he's not allowed to touch her at all. And he's just, and I finally asked the deputy if we could just go sit in the courtroom, because it was just too much. And
incredibly awkward.
Yeah, it's super awkward. There's my client running by in a suit, and his wife at the time is running after him. And I'm just like, oh my God. But there's so many pitfalls.
It can be a lot more subtle than that. Even I saw a case one time where somebody walked into a coffee shop where the protected person was also. They had no contact. They were just both in line. The woman then contacted the police, and this guy got convicted of violating the protective.
Wow.
And that was in general district court.
You got to have that Starbucks sometimes. I mean,
for I God guess.
Sakes. But a lot of the orders have like, don't be within 500 feet or however many feet. So if you're, you know, violating, that's a condition. That's why if you're ever handed a protective order or served a protective order, you should read it over right away and call an attorney right away. Because if you're missing even one condition in there that you don't understand, like I think Chris brought it up a little while ago, the third party contact. When it says no contact, it means no social media. It means no Facebook, no Twitter, no Snapchat.
No sending your friend.
No, smoke signals. You don't send your friend. You can't go leave them Morse a present. Code. You don't get to leave a present on the porch. You know, and judges mean business when they say that. So if you're caught doing those things, I've had cases where people called and it rang and they hung up. They didn't even talk to the person, and the person's bringing in records, you know, and that can be a conviction. So you have to read it over, and it's better to talk to an attorney right away. Like I said, these things get set very quickly, and sometimes you're not served till like a week or so after. So that leaves you even less time to get prepared. And just real quick, Roberto, if you are served, understand that the statute allows you to ask for a continuance when you go to court. It does not state a petitioner can. Now, I know recently there's been some judges that allow petitioners.
They do it all the time. Yeah. It's weird.
Not as much in the district courts, but it's been happening a little bit.
Well, I think it's probably the corona. No, and seriously, the continuances are supposed to be liberally granted now, so that may apply for a petition.
But the statute,
the statute says only the respondent.
You know how that goes and sometimes.
You have judges always trying to push your protective order hearing case after the criminal case is resolved. I like to use it for discovery and to figure out what's going on.
And I was going to comment on that. Sometimes it depends. If you want to fight that protective order and your client's going to testify, I don't necessarily want to have him testify before the criminal case.
Well, I like to take advantage of them not having a lawyer a lot of times, because then the petitioner can't get a continuance.
Yeah. I actually continued a case in Loudoun County about 2 months ago, and I told Ann about it, and she goes, "Why'd you continue it, you knucklehead?" I'm like, you know, come to think of it, I probably didn't do the right. I ended up going back, and I ended up winning that protective order, but Ann was right. I should have just gone forward that day and said, she's not represented by counsel. She never was, and I ended up having the same effect. But
You just need, you know, you're not the king of protective orders.
Right, not at all.
merely a minion of protective orders.
It's like Anne almost did the opposite of knighting me. She almost killed me when I told her that. And I was like, Anne, I'm so sorry. I disappointed you. And it's just an advantage
for people, because if you can get me the records, if they're alleging A, B, and C, and you've got all these evidence or texts or calls that show different, and they don't have a lawyer, and you prepare your client, it's hard. You tie them down to those things. Like they make them easier to win. Like, it's harder for us to win criminal cases than these. And there's a preponderance standard that we got to remember that, like, in a criminal case, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. But in these cases, the judge just has to believe that other side just a little bit more to make them win. And so it doesn't take a lot for these. So if they really can't prove it, a judge is going to dismiss it. And if you're ready to go and can show that person's lying or that they're not meeting the statute, you want to take advantage of it.
Well, what else? The rules of evidence still apply. So you can possibly get some advantage there as well, with knowledge of the rules of evidence, assuming that the judge actually enforces them.
Well,
and if you bring a recorder, you can.
Well,
if you go ahead.
No, I mean, I think that the judges all enforce the rules of evidence, Tony. Sometimes we have different opinions as to what evidence should come in or not. I know.
Sometimes
I do.
The judges and I disagree about what the rules mean.
It happens.
That's why they invented the phrase "note the appeal."
Well, that's an important aspect too. If you're a petitioner and you win your case and note an appeal, or the other side notes an appeal, your protective order will stay in place pending that appeal. But if you're a petitioner and you lose and you want to note your appeal, there is no protective order in place between when you lose that hearing until the new hearing. And people don't understand that a lot of times, but it's a big difference on whether you win or lose and an appeal is noted.
And one of the
things that also dovetails into one of the things Ann said before, which was the judge also has to find that the protective order is necessary to protect the safety and welfare of the petitioner. And if during the appeal period, you don't have any contact with the person that is asking for the protective order, you have an additional argument that the order is not necessary.
It's true. Now, do you think that I'm not going to ask that question. Maybe I should. So attorney's fees, that's something that people should probably talk about or be aware of. Judges can grant attorney's fees to either party, and it's something
regardless of who wins.
And that might be something that could be used to curtail the frivolous filing of a protective order. And it's something that I argue for all the time when I win these, even though it's not often because I don't do them that many times. But still, you know, attorney's fees is something that you can be in jeopardy of having to pay if you're the petitioner or the respondent and you lose.
And I've had cases that were appealed only because attorney's fees were awarded. So I go over that with my client. I'm like, look, if you win here, you maybe don't want to ask for the fees because that could be the end of it. Whereas if the other side loses and has to pay attorney fees, it gives them more incentive, I think, to note an appeal to try to get around that. So it's something that you have to discuss with your client before the court date so they can understand how they want to proceed.
Yep. Does anybody know the standard the juvenile court employs for determining whether to award fees?
Don't they have to see whether or not somebody is capable of paying them? Is that's one of the but honestly, I've seen it done before, and it just I've said it before. It's like, look, no evidence has come up at all during this hearing as to whether or not this person can pay, because support is another element that can be given another condition that can actually be given during a protective order. And many times you try to, people, a petitioner will try to get into that income of the respondent. But without that, I don't see how a judge can actually order.
Especially in the juvenile court, where I thought that for attorney's fees in the juvenile court, I thought the only issue that they're really, other than sanctionable conduct, is if the person has the ability to pay. So theoretically, the loser of the case could collect attorney's fees from the winner because they don't have the ability to afford their counsel. It'd be weird, wouldn't it?
It would be weird.
So one thing we haven't talked about is sometimes, let's say you live with somebody in a romantic relationship or domestic or husband and wife, but you're not the owner of the home. Let's say the husband's the owner of the home.
Ooh, that's
and,
a good one.
And the court awards the wife the ability to stay in that home and the dad can't come back and he hasn't seen his kids and, you know, they're at the home and he's not. That does not take away the fact that dad owns the home. So the options are going to be either they sort that out in a divorce with Chris and figure all those issues out. Or I've had some people that say, I'm going to go sell the house then and they're not staying in. Now that doesn't go well if you have children and there's custody issues and you're trying to kick people out. And, but Chris, you want to talk about that a little bit about how that can play into like a divorce in custody when there's a house.
Well, you have, so you're right. The statute says it doesn't affect the ultimate title of the house or the disposition of the house. I would, if I was the person who received the exclusive use and possession of the house and the other person sold it out from under me, I would argue that you've deprived me of my exclusive use and possession and therefore violated the court order. And I think you would have a very receptive judge for that argument. And that is one of the, again, we were touching on the interplay between the domestic cases and the protective orders. You got to remember, in some of these jurisdictions, especially in juvenile courts, you're getting 15, 30 minutes aside to put on your case. And so if you can quickly strike and get attorney's fees, child support, exclusive use and possession of the house, and a ruling that this person, the other person, is an abuser, that's a pretty powerful ruling that you can get without the benefit of discovery, without the benefit of depositions, without the real ability to cross-examine or put on a full hearing. And that is, I think, why people employ it as much as they do. I also think a lot of judges, they're cognizant of that fact as well. So,
well, and you just brought up another good point is when you have all those separate orders, they have to match. So I've had cases where the bond conditions on a criminal case don't match the protective order, or a custody order for the children isn't matching what the provisions are in the protective order. And so it's really important that you talk with an attorney and get the language if a protective order is being awarded to match up to the, some of those other documents. Otherwise, you've got conflicting things in place. People get confused. It can lead to violations, even for a petitioner not knowing like what they're allowed to do or what the conduct is that, that can be done or not. And so it's really important. I've had to file motions to amend those and get things fixed so that it matches up so nobody's getting in trouble and everyone's on the same page.
I think it's really important to like collaborate with the domestic lawyer. So if you do have a case where there's a, you have gotten a protective order filed against you and you're in a divorce, like make sure your domestic counsel, if they're not going to do the protective order because maybe there's a criminal charge or it's just better to have a criminal lawyer dealing with it, make sure those people are talking to each other. Because just like Ann said, it is so much easier to make sure orders match up and things work out versus, you know, your criminal lawyer does a good job or gets got a good discovery at the protective order hearing and then appeals it, but somehow the continuing protective order hurts your existing custody order. I mean, there's so many things to think about, and it's just better that if you have two counsel that they should be talking to each other. And one thing I wanted to ask Chris, I saw this the other day, but you know, when you have people that are dissatisfied with the final custody determination in a divorce and they are divorced, I saw that a couple who had been divorced for years ended up fighting over custody and using the protective order to try to change custody, even though it had been determined multiple times by the circuit court. How many times do you see sort of that disgruntled parents after a contentious divorce continue to push the issue using protective orders with the children at play?
Usually if the protective order fails once or twice, you won't see it again, but you will see people filing over and over and over again petitions to modify custody and visitation based upon a material change in circumstances, because that's the standard. Anytime there's a material change in circumstances, you can seek a review. I think the most I've ever seen somebody try to do a protective order is twice. But, you know, just like with the boy who cried wolf, at some point, those people lose credibility with the judge. And so even if they come forward, several months down the road with a credible claim, they're not likely to be believed. And so you need to make sure that if you're going to fire the shot for a protective order, it better have some meat to it. Otherwise, it could backfire.
There's also some different strategies. Like, I know years ago when I started doing these, I was shocked when the petitioner's attorney called my client as a witness. And I was like, huh? Because in a criminal case, like the prosecutors don't call our clients as witnesses typically, right. You know, unless they're cooperating against somebody. But so you have to prepare your client for that too. So now whenever I prepare a protective order, I have to prepare my client to tell their side, but we also have to be ready that they're going to be put on the stand by the petitioner. It was just shocking. I mean, I know that's a civil thing, but like it was surprising to me, and it's not something people think about, and you have to be ready for it. Otherwise your client's kind of like, what's going on? Like, why am I being, you know, called to the stand here?
That's another thing on appeals too, right? Doesn't that increase the discovery process? You could be deposed. You can actually have to answer.
I still think you need to have court permission to depose on protective orders. I thought, don't you?
I don't know. I thought that you just could on appeal, because circuit court's like, don't bother me with your you know.
Somebody told me that you had to ask for leave on. I'm not sure if that's correct or not. I don't know.
I mean, I certainly I'm not aware. The juvenile rules are, but right, the last. I think even in your case, Anne, didn't you get one where you got discovery, but they gave you like a scheduling order and everything? Like,
well, Fairfax does a scheduling order. Like when you go to set these, they do them for GDC. It used to be the juvenile case and domestic relations cases. When you appealed, it went to term day where you got a scheduling order for witnesses witness lists, exhibits, experts, depositions, all that stuff. And then it would get set for a hearing. And then GDC,
on a circuit court, you can do depositions. Yes, you can.
Well, and then GDC, it used to be, it got set when you appealed, it went to trial in Fairfax, and now they fixed that. So both courts now, when you know an appeal, you're going for term day to schedule it, and you're going to get a scheduling order where you sides can exchange all those things.
But I've had judges in other jurisdictions in circuit court say, why are we doing discovery? Like, we've gone through discovery and we'll have discovery disputes. And they'll be like, why are we even doing discovery? It's a protective order. What do we need this for? Like, they get irritable when they think it's a relatively discrete issue, even though, like, obviously you have the right to try to build your case as much as possible.
Well, in circuit court, where you're going to get a full hearing, you know, whereas you have a very limited hearing in a lot of the juvenile courts or general district courts. But in circuit court, you get the full panoply of Rule 4:1.
Well, I mean, that comes down to a point of the judges. When you go to the seminars and the judges speak at these, I've had so many, whether it's JDR, circuit, GDC judges, they will tell you if you need a protective order and you can't establish your case within that 10 or 15 minutes, then it usually doesn't rise to the level that you're going to need it. If it's going beyond that, unless it's like something really, really complicated, which it should be rare, there's only a couple things you have to show, and you don't need to prove a ton of acts of violence. You just got to show one. There are judges that believe the longer it takes you to put on your case for a protective order, the less likely it is you're probably going to have it granted.
I like to use the appeal of a protective order for discovery when I have a criminal case pending. It's just part of the game plan, and Chris touched on it before. Sometimes you just want to have that protective order in district court go first, so you can get a court reporter or just record the proceeding to see what the complainant or the prosecutrix will say during the protective order, and then maybe contradict that person in the criminal trial later on. You know, it is definitely a tool, and if for whatever reason they choose to continue the protective order, the petitioner on an appeal, then you have a lot more rights. And I've used that before. I've noticed people for depositions. I've sought admissions, and oftentimes what will happen is the protective order will be withdrawn. They realize all they're doing, or maybe the Commonwealth attorney will get into their ear and say, look, you don't want to go through this. Don't put my victim on the stand.
And we talked about like our clients being actually called in a civil case. Well, the way to avoid that, especially when you're facing criminal charges, is you plead the Fifth. So you're not going to be able to really put on, other than your other witnesses, a defense necessarily to that current protective order. But as Alberto was saying, it's good discovery to lock in the complaining witness into their testimony. And it's strategic. I mean, it's very nerve-wracking for a client when they hear things said about them that maybe they believe are not true, or they want to defend themselves. They really want to testify in those protective order hearings. And you really got to explain, especially when there's a pending criminal charge, that pleading the Fifth in that particular circumstance is the best way to go when you're trying to get discovery in the criminal case.
Well, and the other thing is, in a criminal case, a protective order can be issued as well if you're convicted or even on the deferred findings. And so you have to remember too that maybe you'll lose the civil side, or maybe you push that out till after the criminal case, and then the criminal case resolves it and there's no need to necessarily go forward with the civil case. But some things to remember are, in a civil case, the petitioner is driving that bus and gets to decide whether they want to drop it, modify it, go forward. In a criminal case, it's up to the Commonwealth attorney. So if you want things modified, or you want it dismissed, or you want different things, the Commonwealth attorney or prosecutor in Virginia has to agree, because they're a party to the case. So it gets a little complicated when you have all these different moving parts and there's multiple cases. And then if you add family law like Chris does on top of it, you're looking at even more orders and things that are in play.
And to follow up on that, you can sometimes resolve a criminal case with a protective order, dismiss the criminal charges in exchange for entering into a protective order. And you can sometimes even negotiate how long that protective order is going to last, and only do a 1-year protective order. But now you've just gotten your criminal charges dismissed in exchange for that.
And if there is a divorce lawyer on the other side who is part of the protective order, and say you're on it, Chris, and you're dealing with the divorce as well, are there times when you can negotiate things such as, instead of a protective order, but a mutual no contact, or like some other settlement order that is not, you know, enforceable in other than by contempt? I mean, have you ever done things where, you know, basically you use that opportunity to negotiate with the other side and the other civil side and try to get rid of the criminal matter that way?
Sure. You can have it part of a final order of divorce. Don't harass, molest, or interfere with somebody else. Or you can have it part of a pendente lite temporary order. There's all kinds of things you can try to do. And those types of orders do not bar you from owning a firearm, or do not have the ramifications that a protective order does. But if you incorporate those agreements into an order, if it's not a protective order, it still can be contempt of court for willfully violating that order.
Right. Have you done that a fair amount to negotiate situations like
this? I've tried it a fair amount of times. Getting someone to agree when they think they've got a protective order issue is very difficult. It just depends on how much leverage you have, what you're trying to get, or what they really need from you. The good news is most of the domestic cases don't wind up with, you know, lead-ins with protective orders. And it's usually the really nasty ones that have them. And if they're going to be really nasty, then they're just going to stay nasty. And there's not going to be a whole lot you can do to try to talk them out of prosecuting it.
So the other thing is, I think it was last year, protective orders are usually good for up to 2 years. But last year, if somebody has been convicted of an act of violence, they can actually get a protective order that is up to the lifetime of the defendant. Like if it's very serious, like behavior, it's a longer period of time now.
You can also file a petition to modify it, or even have the protective order dissolved. And I think if the petitioner does it, it can be ex parte, but either party can actually file that written motion.
But it just can't be between the two of you on the phone saying, okay, we're done with this. You have to get the judge to sign off on it.
The court needs to sign off. Otherwise, there's still an order in place.
Bad news if the both of you are on the phone, if one of the provisions is no contact.
That's a problem.
Remember that. And I think there's one type of protective order that we haven't talked too much about, which is on a side note, but it does come up in family law cases. And that's the Child Protective Services protective order that they get when there's an allegation of child abuse. And I don't know how much you see those in maybe not divorce cases, but in custody cases, when one or both parents are considered suspect. Maybe there's a drug overdose. Maybe there are marks on the child that are seen by a school. Do you see that somewhat in your divorce practice, Chris?
No, the ones that I see, those are always the criminal cases, you know, mom ODs, kids running around the house with a dirty diaper, or a kid gets into the mom's stash of Oxy, takes one, those types of things.
It's usually a sexual case where a kid's been abused.
Correct. Right. So those are the ones where you see the CPS or the county files for on behalf of the child to get services to the parents. Usually they use it as leverage to get services to the parents and hopefully can turn them around in order to make the house a safe place for the children to return to. And, you know, the interesting thing about those is you can actually use the services they provide you in connection with those protective order cases and the effort that your client makes to get through that protective order process and use that in connection with your negotiation with a Commonwealth attorney when trying to negotiate an outcome for that criminal case as well. So,
and there's usually guardian ad litems on all those too, on the abuse and neglect, on the next friend where a parent or somebody files it on behalf of a child. A guardian ad litem is an attorney that stands in the place of the parent and helping figure out what's in the best interest of the child. So they're not technically really the child's attorney. They're just standing in to help the court figure out, hey, what should we do? Like, what's the best thing for this kid? And they can often get appointed in those custody cases and on these child abuse, you know.
What we see, what I've seen somewhat, which is just, we talked about how protective orders can keep people from having certain types of employment, is in some jurisdictions, if you are like the person the child is living with while the parents are getting their stuff together, whether it's a foster home or a grandparent, some of those courts try to do a wraparound protective order so that everybody's covered by it. And I've actually seen situations where like that grandparent is a school bus driver or a teacher. And if they get this protective order on their, in their record, they will be fired. And so you've had courts reluctantly remove them from the protective order because the whole point is not to punish people who are actually doing a really good thing if the parents get better. But those protective orders operate the same for people who are people. It looks the same for purposes of owning a firearm, all of the things we talked about earlier, even though those are not the people that have been alleged to do the things that they're not supposed to do.
One other thing we haven't really talked about is, so let's say somebody goes to get a protective order and they can't find the person they're trying to serve. The court has the ability to continue that for up to 6 months. And so if that person hides for over 6 months, guess what? Like, they're not going to go any farther on that protective order. And usually the person's either left the area or stayed away long enough. It would be hard, you know, to meet the standards that they need for the protective order anyway, but you have that 6 month cushion if the respondent is not being served. Sometimes that's on purpose. Sometimes they just can't be found, or the people don't have the right addresses, things like that.
The preliminary protective order can actually stays in place during that time. So if they can serve him or her, that protective order will become effective. I've also had judges extend it more than 1 6-month period. I actually was involved in one where it was extended for 18 months until the person was actually served, but 6 months at a time.
So what about if they're, I don't know if you covered this, if it's issued for the 2 years, can you request to renew it for an additional 2 years afterwards, or do you have to do the entire petition?
You have to file a motion, I think, asking them to extend it. But most judges will tell you they're not going to extend something like that unless something's happened.
Because it's such an extreme remedy. Yeah.
And usually if something's happened, there'll be a new order or something in the interim anyway.
Yeah, or conviction.
They may want to look at how serious the original offense was. Like if the original offense was maybe a serious sexual assault or attempted murder or something, they might do it too. But that's also going to get wrapped up in your probationary orders, right?
Well, and the criminal order too, if there's a, because they can do the, you know, the lifetime ones now. So, but we've been talking for a while, guys. Does anybody have any last words of wisdom about for protective orders?
Hire an attorney. whether or not you're seeking one or you're defending one, go talk to one. There's a lot you can lose. There's a lot that you can gain by getting one as well. But it's best that you talk to someone like Ann or Chris or Anna or Tony or myself, and we'll refer you to Ann and Chris. Just joking. We do them as well. It's, you know, it's just tough.
But what I'll say on, for my last thing is that read the orders. If you get served, read it. Make sure you understand it. Whether you're a petitioner or somebody being served with it, like Alberto said, talk to an attorney. At least understand like what you're going up against, because these can be pretty difficult, especially if you really are afraid of somebody, or if you're stressing about losing your home or your children or your job or things like that. So it's really, make sure you don't violate and at least consult someone so you know what you're looking at when you go to court.
If I could add to that, I had one guy come in and I said, look, it's a civil case. You can go, you can do it alone if you'd like it. And he goes, what can happen? I'm like, she get an order that says you can't come back for 2 years. He goes, she wants me away for 2 years. He ran out of there and said, that's great. And never, I don't think he went to court, nothing. He was just like, I have my ticket out. But anyhow, he didn't pay me either.
Nothing that's like a little crime. Free advice.
That's why you consult a lawyer. You know your options and you know how you want to handle it.
He was so happy. Tony, anything from you?
I would just say, if you are in fear of somebody and you're not sure if you can get a protective order, go talk to that lawyer. Find out if what is happening meets the requirement. It might be a close call and might be worth putting it up for a hearing, or the lawyer might tell you that this is not what it's meant to do, but you should definitely get the information.
And the only thing I would say too is to piggyback on that is for those people who feel like don't have the money to get a lawyer, at least if you want a protective order and you feel in fear and all the things that we've talked about, you meet all those criteria, or at least you think you do, Legal Services of Northern Virginia has a program to help people get protective orders who cannot afford them. So please, you know, if you're in the Northern Virginia area, and I think this is the case for the rest of Virginia and the different legal aid areas, that they really focus on domestic violence and also just generally violence. If they can help you because you have no money, like they can. So that don't let that be a deterrent for not trying to go to get the services that you can. And if you are defending, you know, as soon as you get a copy of that protective order, do not call the petitioner. Don't call them. Don't send them an email. Don't send them a text message. Don't call their friend to talk to them. Don't say if you can get your stuff. Go call a lawyer, but just read that order and contact a lawyer. That's all I got to say.
And Chris, since you are a special guest tonight, what words of wisdom would you like to end with tonight for our listeners?
All the attorneys who have been speaking on this issue tonight have given you great advice. That's why they're tops in their field. And I want to thank all of my friends for allowing me to come back on your show. And I hope it was informative for your listeners.
Our only two-time guest, Chris Holly. Thank you very much for being here. And he will be a three-time guest. No, he will be a three or four.
All right, Chris, now everybody say it together. Let's go, Penn.
Thanks for joining us on Crime Time. Please join us again for our next episode.